an Vedic style band. There's a rock band, and it's just a kind of complete show. I call it the Indradrumna Swami show. Mm-hmm. And it's the world sankirtan party that Prabhupada wrote about, that's sort of taken a few steps beyond. And this last year, he made friends with a Polish gentleman who's very well noted for his charity. He's a millionaire. And there was a kind of Polish Woodstock that took place, organized by this man. And he liked the devotees so much that he got them a tent, got them a special stage, gave them top billing, introduced them, and talked about them several times as he was kind of like an MC. And in the last performance, he himself went on stage with a tilak and a dhoti and a kurta, and his wife and five or six of the other ladies that worked for him all were there in saris wearing gopi das and tilak, and they were on stage chanting and dancing. And now he wants to come to India and further his studies in Krishna consciousness, but it was like the culmination of, you know, a big expenditure and big event in Poland for people, for thousands and thousands of people that came to this event, and the Hare Krishnas were like the stars of it because of him, because of this man, and because of Indradrumna Maharaj's way of making Krishna consciousness so accessible and so palatable. In addition to all this, there are book stands and stands selling all kinds of paraphernalia like beads and photographs and saris. Many people, I saw a video of it, many of the girls, ladies were wearing saris. They just rented them out, you know, like for the night. They could wear saris. And you could see these people wearing saris. They didn't really know how to wear them. They were a little crooked and, you know, bulging out and so on. But that was part of the thing. And they would sell books. And one of the ways they'd sell books was that he'd autograph them. There'd be a big long line of people standing just to get the autograph of him because he was the leader of the thing. And went to some of these, and there'd be a huge queue line of maybe 50, 80 people all the time just waiting to get the book signed. And then there was massive prasadam distribution. I think prasadam, as I remember, was distributed free, and they paid for the other things. So, and they traveled about in two or three school buses. They stayed in high schools all summer long. We stayed there. And then another thing that happened was that Nelson Mandela, who's a very admired person now, came to the temple twice. And he's planning to come to the Rath Yatra in Durban, which is taking place on the 26th of December this year. And that's also kind of Indradrumna Maharaj's thing. He organizes that festival. And another thing was that Lokanath Swami was also given a directive of Prabhupada that he should take a bullet cart to every village and town in India and give a complete presentation of Krishna consciousness, distribute books, distribute the holy name, make devotees, and distribute lots of prasadam. So he's been doing this over the last several years. But then he took it beyond India and started doing it in other countries where they actually took bullocks and made carts and distributed the holy name, prasadam, and books, and made devotees. And so it was like a whole Krishna conscious temple on wheels, and it's now reached 100 and just over 100 countries. These parades take place. So it's been like a little mini exposition or a temple on wheels in 100 countries where there's intensive prasadam and book distribution and chanting. And it also talks about simple living and high thinking, because there's bullocks, oxen, and books about how the farms work and take it to taste what it's like. So Lokanath Maharaj has been this year, this last 1996, has been the chief organizer of the centennial, and all these different things he's kind of been coordinating and developing and publicizing throughout the whole world. So he's kind of another one of the special heroes of the centennial. So all this is being done because Prabhupada is such an extraordinary person that his power to influence people has become greater in his physical absence. When he was here, sometimes we took him for granted. You know, he was always very obliging for the most part, and it was very difficult not that we tried to do, but it was hard to understand how great he really was. He was someone we could talk to, but he didn't, in our minds, have the stature of a personality who would change the whole structure of the world, or someone who had an agenda for social change, something to do really radical things to make society just change, to become more Krishna consciousness, more Varnashram, more decentralized, more agrarian, less sectarian, less materialistic. All these visions that he had, we kind of knew about them, but we sort of just were more interested in his personal quality. So when I met Prabhupada, the first impression I had, well, first of all, I didn't even know he existed until a friend of mine told me about him. He referred to him as the old Swami. And he wanted to know if I'd met the old Swami. And I was on a bus in New York City. And I was a searcher because I'd been to see so-called holy people, Christians and Buddhists. And I was getting a little jaded about, you know, if anyone was genuine. And I just was sort of like kind of pursue a spiritual quest by reading books and not trying to meet people so much. So when he told me about Prabhupada, that he was living in the Bowery, I thought, well, this is definitely worth going to, because most of the so-called spiritualists were in living kind of affluent lifestyle, and they got sort of pessimistic, I guess, or cynical, going to see Swamis where they were people that were all over middle-aged, sitting in leather chairs, smoking pipes, and going there to get healed or something like that. So it was, you know, that was a New York scene. And, you know, if you wanted to have a guru or holy man, you'd kind of go for it. Or, you know, they'd kind of sing songs, talk, and couldn't really understand what they were saying. It was kind of like a hypnotic, kind of a drone, you know. So when I heard it was the Bowery, I thought, ah, you know, this may be, you know, it's not some sort of a, you know, money thing, a lot of rich supporters or, you know. So the room in which Prabhupada was staying was a really ramshackle affair. It was, it's maybe about the size of this room we're in now, but it was cobwebs in the ceiling, no proper sort of ceiling, just naked beams and light bulbs hanging. And on wires, and you know, it was a bit dingy. And then he was chanting. When I first came in, I just saw he was chanting on a little platform. It was about maybe 6 feet by 4 feet, 2 feet off the ground, and he had a little African drum he was playing. It was no mridanga, and so he chanted, and then I said, there was about five or six people, and he started to speak. And when he spoke, he had kind of a plaintive sense of urgency in his speaking, like it was really intense. And he kept saying, "I'm not this body. I'm not this body." It would just come out every once in a while, "I'm not this body." But he said it with such conviction, with such absolute conviction. It was almost like he was incredulous in thinking that anyone couldn't believe it, or that anyone could think any differently. So it made a very big impact. I mean, I kept mulling this thing over in my mind, "I'm not this body." And then when he finished, I thought, well, you have to ask him a question, because he asked your questions. So I was always kind of thinking about really strange things. You know, I didn't know what spiritual life was like. So, I was reading these Zen books and books on Taoism and Buddhism. So, you know, all the big questions of life come up. You know, how do you act in certain situations? They tend to give these kind of enigmatic answers that don't really tell you anything. So I decided to kind of ask him an enigmatic question. So my question was, if you were walking along the street and you saw two people fighting, a young a man was beating up on an old man, would you interfere? Would it be the right thing to do? Or would you walk on? Would you try to save the person? That's my question. So Prabhupada answered in a very long answer, and basically he said that you have to come to the spiritual platform of life, and if you don't enter onto the spiritual platform of life, you can never know what to do. You can never know what's right action, what's wrong action. So it was really, to me, it was a very convoluted answer. I couldn't understand it. I didn't know what the spiritual platform was, for one thing. I couldn't imagine what the spiritual platform was, and what to speak of how to get to it. So I just thought, you know, he was kind of like evading my question. So I said, well, I don't think you answered my question. So then he launched into this long explanation again about coming to the spiritual platform. And then I thought, all right, I just don't know, you know, what he's talking about. And I kind of made up my mind that there were some things that I just couldn't understand yet, and I shouldn't argue because it was beyond me. It was probably right, but I'd have to really study it. So I just kind of let it. Then I think he said something like, you understand, and I just kind of said, well, I'm not sure, but I'm going to try. And then there were a few other questions, and then we chanted again. He led the chant, and a few people chanted. So then I thought, well, you know, Prabhupada had in my mind the status of being some extraordinary person, so I thought the next step is, and I'm here alone in this loft, there's a loft in the Bowery, so I can go up and talk to him. No one's going to stop me, and I'll have a chance, you know, to have some personal discussion with him. So it was kind of thinning out a little bit in the room, and so I just walked up to him, and he was sitting, and I was standing, so he was kind of looking up. And he had a big smile on his face, and I didn't really know what I was going to say. I had no idea what I was going to say. I just thought, well, you know, it's time to have some personal discussion. So I had some Indian instruments. I was very interested in India. I was planning to go to India, and I had a bunch of Indian instruments and Indian friends. And so I said, I have a tambura. That was the very first thing that came out. I didn't have any plan I was going to say. That was my first sentence. And without missing a beat, he just said, then bring it. Oh, okay. And he just had this huge smile on his face. And he reminded me, even before that, of my grandfather, my father's father. It was always, you know, in a very good mood, very happy, and, you know, never got on my case like my father did. He was just always like, yeah, it's great, you know, whatever you want to do, we'll go out and do this or that. So he looked like him. He had a kind of similar shape of his head and similar countenance. So I just got that feeling. It was a very warm feeling, affectionate feeling. He didn't, you know, there was just no questions about who are you, what do you want, or, you know, what are you talking about to him, words, but just bring it, you know, just do it. So I thought, I mean, you know how thoughts just kind of race through your mind so quick you can't articulate them. And this is what was going through my mind. Well, yeah, you're telling me to bring a tambura, so there's really not much point in carrying on this discussion much further, because I was going to have a discussion with him. But then I thought, well, he's inviting me to come again, and I'm going to be able to bring my instrument, and that means I'll be able to play while he sings. And, you know, I didn't think there was much else, you know, to have to discuss, because to me that would be an experience that would be much more important than having a philosophical discussion. So that's what kind of went through my mind in about 1 second. So I thought, that's good. I'll just leave it at that. I said, okay. And it was like more than I had hoped for, because I thought, you know, there'd be some kind of discussion, and I wouldn't get, you know, we wouldn't really have a kind of meeting of the mind. You know, I had tried in the past to talk to people who were of stature. It was always kind of like unfulfilling or disappointing or something. So I thought, wow, this is a good opportunity. So that was kind of the way we left it. And so the next, and he was talking there, I think Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So I very dutifully came back, my tambura on my hand the second time. And so he saw me way at the back of the room. It's kind of a long, thin room. He went like this. I had no idea what that meant. I never saw anybody do that before. Yeah. So I just kept walking towards him. You know, he kept going like that. And then I was like practically right on top of him. And he kept going like that. So I didn't know what else to do. I just sat down with my tambura. That means sit down, is what it means. Come here and sit down. So then he was chanting, and I was sitting up close to this rostrum thing, this platform. And he was kind of acknowledging that I was there. He was chanting, and he was kind of looking, playing his drum. And I was trying to frantically tune this thing so it would be in the same key. And then I thought I had it, and then I was watching him, and he just was like, at a certain point, he just came completely oblivious to the fact that I was there. And he just kept chanting and chanting, and then I was sure, well, this isn't the right program or the right tune or the right key. So then I changed it. You know, I started tweaking with the strings and trying to change the knobs and getting a different tune. I went through all these contortions trying to figure out what kind of a melody was, whether it was a major or minor or diminished or augmented or whatever. And finally, I just kind of just said, okay, you know, he's happy, I'm happy, I'm just, you know, playing the tambourine. So then, you know, then he talked again. And then the end, there was another chant, and since I was a little bit more relaxed, I didn't care so much about what the melodies were. And I just felt very comfortable to be there, like he really was somehow acknowledging. And, you know, it was a feeling like you're supposed to be here. It was kind of like a family feeling. There was a few other people, but he was like the center point. The thing that made everything worthwhile. So then there were other meetings. And one time I didn't come because on the weekends I would work sometimes, Saturday night, Friday night. And I was a musician then, and I tried not to work as much as I could. So maybe just once or twice, a week, in the evening. So anyway, one night I didn't come because I had to work. It was a Friday night, and I came back on the Monday, and he said, "Where were you?" And just as soon as I came in, "Where were you?" And I said, "Oh, I had to work." And I thought, you know, it's natural, you have to work. Everybody has to work. And he just looked at me like, "So what?" You know. That doesn't mean you shouldn't have come. And I was pretty amazed that he did that, because it was like a look of disapproval. And it was the first time since I met him that I had this kind of feeling that he disapproved of something I did. It really struck me, because, you know, everybody has to work, and it should just be something that anyone would accept very easily. But he didn't accept it. And then I started thinking about it more and more, and came to the conclusion that it wasn't so much that I had to work that he was objecting to. It was just the fact that I didn't come, that you know, we'd started some kind of a relationship, and he thought it was going to be three times a week, and then it just wasn't. So I got the feeling that he was actually hurt somehow. Maybe not a lot, but it was that kind of a move. It was two things. It was that he was a little hurt, and that I wasn't doing what was the best thing for me, for my spiritual life, that I really should have been there. I shouldn't have missed the instruction, the lecture, the chanting, that it was important, more important than mine, whatever I had to do, whether it was to work, to earn a living, or whatever. So that had a pretty big impact. And then one day I decided to go and see him in the afternoon, sort of more informal visit, where I thought I'll just go out and talk. So it was on the Bowery, and the Bowery near the Manhattan Bridge in New York is a very busy street. There's two lanes in each direction, and it's very noisy. Have you ever been there? There's trucks. And I had what they call an artist-in-residence loft right near that, not far from where he was. It was very cheap. I was paying $50 a month rent. This big, big place. Had it all fixed up. But, you know, the neighborhood was terrible. So I tried to go in and the door was locked. So then I started to call up to this boy who lived up there, Paul. And Paul, and you know, the trucks were rumbling by, and I just thought, he can't hear me. I think he's called David in this book because for legal reasons, he didn't want to use his real name. But anyway, I was going, Paul, nothing. So then I took to what New Yorkers sometimes do when they can't get any response from someone on the upper floor and started to throw pennies at the window. No, I mean, playing baseball really helped because after a few tries I was starting to hit it every time. And then and all of a sudden Prabhupada came to the window and he looked out. He kind of threw the window open and looked down at me like that, and I felt so horrible that it wasn't Paul, it was Prabhupada himself. That, you know, here I was throwing pennies at the window. And he looked at me and he went like that, as if to say, okay, you know, just wait a minute. And I thought, maybe Paul's not there, and maybe he's going to walk all the way down the stairs, let me in, and he's going to have to walk all the way back up. So I waited, and then sure enough, Prabhupada himself came to the door, opened the door. And I was really apologetic. I kept trying to say, you know, I'm really sorry, I didn't mean for you to come down the stairs, I thought Paul was there. Now you have to go all the way back. And he said, no, he said, come on. He just said, come on, didn't say anything else. And then he started walking up. It was like three flights of stairs. And he had the front of his dhoti pulled up, and he was taking them two at a time. And I was amazed because I just didn't expect that he would be going in two at a time. And so fast. So then I went in there, and he was just there by himself. And it was an August day, and very hot in New York, and that Bowery, it actually smells like a mixture of urine and beer. That's what it's like. It's, you know, there's these flop houses and drops that time of year especially, and then we're just sometimes we're just laying on the street. And it was real hot up there. He was in the top floor, and I went behind for the first time, this kind of divider. He would talk on this platform, there's a divider behind him, so for the first time I went on the other side of the divider, and there were clothes hanging. His clothes looked like he'd been washing them himself, just hanging on a line. And an old Underwood typewriter with stacks of manuscript paper all around it. And that was his Bhagavad Gita. That was his first Bhagavad Gita. So he just sat down and started talking. And he asked me what my plans were and what I wanted to do with myself. And I told him that I was a musician. And at some point, we were talking about the political history of India. That was something I was kind of interested in. And so he had talked about Gandhi and Nehru, and he just started ripping into these people like they were just materialists and they ruined India. I thought, wow, this is really heavy stuff, you know. I thought these were good people. And you know, now Prabhupada is just dismantling everything that I thought about them that was good and righteous and beneficial and all that. But at the same time, there was so much truth in it that I kind of accepted it. Because I didn't, what did I know? I just read some books. Here was someone who had lived there. He knew the culture, he knew the language. I'd never been to India before. And I just thought, I mean, I trusted him. And I thought, you know, it's a little heavy, but there's something to this. And I think I even had a picture of Jawaharlal Nehru, some picture somebody gave me. And he was just, this man, he's an Englishman and he's corrupt and this and that. And I was actually very interested in all this. It was like the hidden history of India's political past. So he talked about that for a long time. Just went into it. And I think he kind of wanted to be sure that he kind of dismantled any misconceptions that I might have. So then I told him I was planning to go to India, and what was I going to do there? And I said, well, I'm going to study music more. I'm going to learn how to play the flute. And he said, oh. He said, Indian flute players, you know, they vomit blood. And I said, oh, really? I'd never heard of that before. A friend of mine had actually gone there and studied. I never heard about him vomiting blood. Then he asked me what was my instrument. I said, I played the keyboards. He said, I could teach you how to play the piano for Krishna. And I thought, wow, piano for Krishna, is that possible? Because I thought Krishna played the flute, and you know, if you were going to play some kind of music for Krishna, it would have to be some Indian instruments, like at least a sitar or something. So then I kind of got the feeling, well, he was just trying to get me to do something for whatever he was doing. I knew he had some kind of a plan. So I became a little bit frightened that you know, he was going to sort of envelop me in some kind of movement that was going to change my whole lifestyle. And I kind of felt myself shrinking back a little bit from that. So anyway, talked about more things, and then a little bit more about his plan, what he wanted to do, and how he wanted to have a big feast up there and invite lots of people, and you know, kind of led on to different things. And he told me he was going to have a feast. And then this Paul wasn't there, so it was just kind of mostly, as I remember, he was talking about the politics of India. He didn't get into like a lot of depth about Lord Chaitanya and Krishna consciousness philosophy. I think he kind of knew where I was at. I was just kind of a real mundaner, so he kept me a little entertained. And then he had the feast, and it was in the same place. So it was on an afternoon, and it was the first time that Prabhupada was kind of walking around, you know, not in a formal lecture situation. What he was doing was serving out prasadam. He and a couple of other devotees had made kachoris and puris and a sabji made of chickpeas, gram, and five or six other things, halava, most of which had never tasted before. And he was walking around insisting that everybody take seconds and thirds and fourths. And it was the first time we tended to notice that Prabhupada was very short in stature compared to most of us. And he had a completely different demeanor. He was very smiling and jovial and happy as he kept inducing everyone, take more, take more, take more. So that was a very informal kind of situation in which he displayed a completely different aspect of his personality. Like, he was a friend of everyone. He wasn't just, you know, the rishi, the sage, the dignitary, the distinguished scholar. But he was the gracious host and great cook and just sayer of all kinds of enjoyable things. You know, he would kind of make little jokes. So that was a completely different perception. And then from that day too, people began to see Prabhupada in a different light, that he was actually someone who could go and have a great lunch, or you know, he would teach you how to cook, or so many things. So then when this Paul was taking LSD, apparently, we didn't know, he was 18 and was giving Prabhupada a hard time. So Prabhupada had to move from that place, and I helped him get a place in Second Avenue. And on the day that we made an appointment with Mr. Gardner, who was the rental agent, Prabhupada came, and we all met with another man named Carl, and it was at 26 Second Avenue. I found this address in it, in the Village Voice, that was just off the press. So we had first I came, and then Gardner came, and I started telling him about Prabhupada, who he was, very distinguished man, etc., etc. Then Carl and Prabhupada came, and we went and sat down inside the shop. It was a nationalist gift shop. And we started to talk about arrangements. So I said, well, yeah, you can have this place, it's $100, and there's this apartment across the courtyard for $85. Can have that. It'll take me 4 days to paint it, and it just all went very fast. And So it was just kind of, okay, we agree, we'll pay them. And then he said that now this Carl and Michael, Mr. Michael and Mr. Carl, he used to call us by our first names, Mr. in front. They're trustees of our society. And I want you to have these books, by the way. And he gave him a copy of all three books, all three volumes of the first canto, and signed them. He was really kind of sheepish. He said, oh, you shouldn't really. No, I want you to take them. He was kind of leaping through them. And then he went on to say that these two boys are trustees of our society, and I'd like you to also be a trustee of our society. So he had the books, and Prabhupada was asking to be a trustee. He said, okay. And then Prabhupada went on to say, so that our trustees, these boys, they pay a subscription of $20 a month as trustees, so we would like you to also pay. But since you're our landlord, if you could just deduct that much from our rent every month, that would be fine. So he was really taken aback, but he agreed. And so instead of paying $100 a month, he only had to pay $80 a month. It was a good meeting, and then he just said, you know, in 4 days it'll all be ready. He's going to paint the apartment, and then there was a big move. We moved Prabhupada from Bowery. It was about a mile long walk, and it was a very hot summer day, and no one had thought to get a car. It was just like, we all go there and we're going to move him. It reminded me of a safari. There were about 10 or 15 people, and everybody was carrying something. Prabhupada came with practically nothing, but by the time he'd been there for a few months, he had all sorts of things. I remember I was carrying this reel-to-reel tape recorder on my shoulder all the way, and I was like sore for a week afterwards. And at one point, I remember seeing Prabhupada carrying two suitcases. I don't know how long that lasted, but it was just horrible. I mean, when you think of it, you know, I remember that image of him carrying two big suitcases. I don't think it was the whole way or anything, but just unimaginable how, you know, that happened, that could be allowed to happen. But he did. Anyway, somehow we wound up over at 26th Second Avenue. And at that point, I didn't have so much personal contact with Prabhupada. I would come, because I didn't live there. Some devotees immediately started living there and sleeping there. But one day he just kind of casually announced that he was going to be leaving and going back to India. It's like he had been coming there for about a month and a half or 2 months, and all of a sudden, boom, now I'm going back to India. And everyone's going, what is he talking about? What's he doing? And then we had a little huddle with him after the class, and he said that his visitor's visa was a 6 months, and he got it extended 6 months, and now it was going to expire, and that that they weren't going to renew it. So then it was time to call in the heavy lifters. So Ramananda was there, and Gargamuni, and they asked Allen Ginsberg to come over and see if they could help the situation, because he was coming regularly to the classes by then in the evening, and he was like the big folk hero of the day. So then we had a little meeting with Allen and Prabhupada, and it was just about four or five of us, and we were all sitting around discussing it. And it wasn't really clear, because Prabhupada just had made this announcement that he was going to go back to India. And so Alan said to him, he said, well, are you, he said, what do you want to do? Are you, you want to go back to India? Or do you want to stay here? I mean, we have to know what you want to do. And Prabhupada didn't, he just kind of looked around at the devotees. And then he said, well, he said, I have my disciples here. And it was just the way he said it and the way he looked. It was almost like a really sad look. That I don't want to leave them, and they don't want me to leave. Therefore, you know, I have to stay. He didn't say it. He just said, I have my disciples here. And he said it in this kind of tentative way. He said, I have my disciples here. And from that, Allen Ginsberg could understand that Prabhupada wanted to stay. And so he said, I have some contacts in the federal government, and I'll be able to get you an indefinite stay if you just turn it over to me. I know a lawyer who will do it, and that's it. So it was something like we had to pay $200 just to get the papers all processed, and then everyone's really relieved, because it actually came to pass that he got Prabhupada an indefinite stay of his visa. And then I was going to go to to India, and I told Prabhupada I was going to go and asked him if he knew anybody, and he gave me some names. He gave me the name of someone named Chandrasekhar Sharma, who I never met, who was one of the disciples back then. And so I'll just point this out. He said, I remember at one point, and this I have to back up a little bit, back on the Bowery, I asked if he could give a Sanskrit classes. I don't know why, I just thought, I'll ask him. So he said, yeah, but we can't do it on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night. We'll have to do it on a different time, Saturday morning. So, okay, that was it. There was going to be a Sanskrit class on Saturday morning. So I had gotten this book called First Lessons in Sanskrit Grammar by Judith Tyberg, and it had a little sketch. It's kind of a diagram of how to make Sanskrit, how to make Devanagari characters with a certain kind of pen, you know. This is the stroke one, stroke two. So I was like into really making it look good. So he had this chalkboard. It was crumbling around the edges on an old easel. And there was about four people who came up to this Sanskrit class. And he was writing, and the board itself was also kind of rough and deteriorating on the surface. But somehow he managed to scrawl on there, Ishwara Padama Krishna, Satchitananda Vigraha. He had the whole thing written out in Devanagari, Nadiwadi Govinda Prabhakarana Karana. And he had us speak it. He'd say, now this is Ishwara, and this is Krishna. This is Pava. So we actually, by the time this class was over, which only ran about 2 hours, maybe not even that long, we had learned this verse from the Brahma Samhita. Everybody knew it by the time, you know, the class was over. And I think he had maybe two or three more Sanskrit classes, and then it just dwindled so much that there wasn't any more interest in it. But he would come around and make sure we were making all the Devanagari letters right. And that we knew what the meaning of the words were. So I had a discussion with him over at 26th Second Avenue when I was planning to go to India, and I kind of understood that he wanted to expand Krishna consciousness movement. So I said, well, maybe we should go to California because there's a lot of interest in spiritual life. So I'd been to L.A. and There was at one time a restaurant on Sunset Avenue. I think it was run by the Self-Realization Fellowship. I'm not sure. But it was kind of a nice place.
They used to have a kitchen on Sunset.
This was a place where you could walk in like and sit down and there were tables.
Yeah, they had a restaurant.
And people in saris.
That was my calling on Sunset.
Yeah. So I'd been to that place. That was the SRF.
Yeah.
Well,
that was like
we only had the cafe open in the
60s. Yeah. That was the 1960s sometime. So, and I just kind of knew there was a big movement that, you know, as Yogananda and all kinds of things like that. So I said, yeah, maybe you should go out there to Los Angeles. And then somehow I said, because, you know, people like, they'll appreciate Krishna. And then I just found myself saying, Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchitananda Vigraha, because it was the only thing I knew. I don't know why I said it. I said the whole verse. And then all of a sudden he just kind of lit up like a light bulb, just went boom like that. So happy. And then I realized what I'd said, and that, you know, somehow just the very fact that I'd repeated some Sanskrit, he was like completely elated, totally. And I was surprised. I was very surprised, and I thought that he was going to kind of take this whole thing seriously. So anyway, I was saying goodbye and offered my obeisances, and then as I was walking out, I heard a voice from behind me say, because he knew that I was going to go to California before going to India. That's the thing I told him. So I just heard this voice behind me saying, just see if you can start one center for Krishna consciousness in California. That would be a very great service. And I just started to stop, you know, am I hearing right? I said goodbye, and now he's trying to get me to stay there, I wasn't sure, you know, I just kind of nodded my head. I was like almost down the stairs. And I don't think I even turned around. I might have just sort of acknowledged it. Anyway, I ultimately decided not to go to India, and I was keeping in touch with Prabhupada by mail all the time I was traveling, and ended up staying in California. And that's another chapter. We paid for an air ticket about 4 months after that. And it was about three months. Then he came to California and we started the center in San Francisco. Anyway, those are some sharing of some early moments.
What happened to the
center? To the most recent one? Let me just think for a minute what happened to it. I think the person that was running it decided to go to Eugene and move the whole thing over there. I think he just shut it down and went to Eugene about 6 months ago. In a way, it's too bad because, I mean, I think something else will open up there, but the people of San Francisco really came to appreciate the devotees, and they really liked it because the place had been overrun with, well, first of all, there was the flower people, the Summer of Love, 1967, and people really liked it. It was like an influx of young people, and there were a lot of more spiritually inclined. But then over a period of about a year and a half, these kind of underworld elements came in, and there was drug wars and all kinds of murders and, you know, kind of unsavory things that started to happen, racial struggles. So what happened was this kind of convergence happened. All these young people, very kind of clean living came, and then it kind of deteriorated into another kind of scene. So it just kind of came, it was like a season, you know, like the fall, the leaves fall down and they blow away, and then they came and then they went. But during that time, the devotees had a reputation for being a kind of a stabilizing force in the community. There was a lot of truancy. There were a lot of young, like 13 to 18-year-olds who weren't going to school, and there were truant officers disguised as drug pushers, and all kinds of crazy things were going on. There was a big influx. There were thousands and thousands of people moved into this one area of Haight-Ashbury. So devotees were known as having a very stabilizing influence on the whole community. And just to give you one example, there was a night, in the middle of the night, I heard this shrieking voice, Krishna, Krishna. I was sleeping right above the temple, and it was like a cracking and breaking up, Krishna, Krishna. I was a mad person. I just rolled over and went back to sleep. What actually took place then, there was this boy had been out with some friends, and they were all taking LSD, and they just somehow or other decided to play some kind of a joke on him, and they got all their cars facing in a circle and started flashing on the lights off and on, honking horns, and he began to go a little crazy, because it's a hallucinatory drug. So he sort of flipped, and the police came at some point and they found him, and they just couldn't control him. They were trying to hold him down, and he was just hysterical, screaming Krishna, Krishna all the time. So they didn't know what to do. They thought, we could take him to a mental hospital, we can put him in a jail, but that's not going to do anything. Well, if he's calling Krishna, we'll just take him to the Krishna temple. So they just dropped him off, at 2 in the morning. And in this hysteria, he was screaming, so two of the boys who were living in the temple came out and brought him in, and they started to have a kirtan. And then gradually he began to calm down and started to join the chanting, and he just completely came out of his hysteria. So I had rolled over and gone back to sleep, and then I went down to the temple for the morning program. And this, when I walked in, I saw there was a new person sitting there, this kind of young guy, long hair. didn't think much of it, and sat down, and we were having a kirtan, and then a police car drove up, and these two police came up to the door, and they were kind of like this, and they said, "Hey, Michael," and this guy looked up at him. It was the same two police that dropped him off, and one of them had his wallet. I guess he left it in the police car, and he just tossed it up, and he said, "Here's your wallet." They said, "Okay, thanks." Then they kind of smiled and waved and went away. And then the devotees told us this whole story about what had happened, and then I guess he had told them what happened. It was pretty interesting. And the police came to respect us because they saw that they called them people who were having bad trips. They could come to the Hare Krishna place and they'd get smoothed out just by chance. when we had a performance at the Avalon Ballroom, Allen Ginsberg gave a speech. Prabhupada was there. And this was in January of 1967. And he said how powerful and important the mantra was. And he said, "It's something if you ever have a bad trip in acid, this will stabilize you on re-entry." But he'd heard that story. So, the people of San Francisco, they really liked, and still to this day, they have very, very warm remembrances of the devotees. It was like all of a sudden this wave of people came into their area, and the Hare Krishnas were like the real stable force, that we know we didn't do anything wrong, we didn't take any drugs, and we helped people, and we gave them food, we fed them, and if they were serious, we gave them a place to stay. And sometimes